First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak and for putting up together this excellent conference, and thank you all for being here. I will overview in this talk some of intriguing effects occurring in lanthanum 2-1-4 when it is weakly doped. I believe there are many reasons to pay attention what's going on at this weak doping in lanthanum 2-1-4 systems. First of all, pure lanthanum 2-1-4 without strontium is a prototypical Mott-Hubbard insulator, and it's often perceived that most exciting properties of doped phases are maybe related to proximity to antiferromagnetism on the left-hand side of this phase diagram. Therefore, it seems imperative to explore in as many details as possible how exactly the conducting state comes about at this weak doping. This is in part useful in the context of superconductivity that occurs at around 5-6% in lanthanum 2-1-4, but not only. Weakly doped phases reveal evidence for the formation of self-organized charge and spin ordered textures referred to as stripes, and this seemed to be a common theme for several classes of oxides, and I think it's fair to say that structural aspects of stripes are reasonably well understood. However, and in special cases it became possible to image them, although that still remains quite controversial. However, we don't really know much about. I'll talk about differences between diagonal and collinear stripes a little. That's just a cartoon for illustrative purposes. I think we are definitely lacking clear understanding of the involvement of stripes in the electronic properties, and in part because in most instances it was impossible to perform direction-dependent studies of charge response, of optical properties, of DC transport in the systems, and that's what we are trying to correct with the help of Yuichi Ando and his team that supplied us with untwinned single crystals of weakly doped lanthanum 2-1-4 phases, with untwinned phases that permit this direct studies of the anisotropy. It can be argued that lanthanum 2-1-4 is not the best system to study doping effects, and that's because these crystals are disordered. And I guess that's true. However, in infrared experiments, the impact of disorder is typically confined to very low energies. So using information in the frequency domain, we can separate properties related to disorder and intrinsic behavior of these systems. And in fact, lanthanum 2-1-4, these crystals coming from Ando's group, do not really appear that disordered compared to other cuprates, unless we deliberately put some impurities in these materials. So work that I will be presenting has been carried out by Michael Doom, who was a postdoc in my group, and my students, Sasha Dordievich and Vili Padilla. This is the outline of my talk, and I will start with a brief survey of the phase diagram of these materials, and then I will talk about principal features of the electronic response at of weakly doped phases. data generated with local probes in this region of the phase diagram are often suggestive of phase separation, but I don't think we can reconcile our experiments with this point of view. I will talk about unexpected metallic behavior of weakly doped phases, and also about superconductor insulator transition and around 5% doping in this region of the phase diagram, and also about 1/8 Well, then I will talk about impact of spin stripes on charge dynamics in weakly doped phases and also at 1/8 doping. If time permits, I probably would be able to say a few words about our first attempts to extend this phase diagram in the third dimension by applying magnetic field. We looked at the dynamics of Josephson vortices in weakly doped crystals. Question mark doesn't refer to the, you know, to the existence of Josephson vortices. We know they exist, but I'm not sure that I would be able to cover this material. So I have a few items here. And I will start by saying, I will also need to say a little bit about in our technique infrared spectroscopy. So we are all familiar with this cartoon representation of the phase diagram that shows emergence of superconducting phase when we doped antiferromagnetic insulator with charge carriers. If you start paying closer attention to what's going on, we find a lot of action in this weakly doped phases. First of all, there is a structural transition here from high temperature tetragonal to orthorhombic phase, and this transition involves the tilt of the oxygen octahedron. In the electronic sector, we find unmistakable evidence for a metal insulator transition around 5% doping. So resistivity, temperature dependence of resistivity of weakly doped phases shows the semiconducting upturn, and beyond 5-6% resistivity is metallic and these crystals are superconducting. Another interesting region of the phase diagram is this pseudo gap shown schematically here, and then again, an advantage of weakly doped materials is that we can study the pseudo gap behavior down to the lowest temperatures without interference of superconductivity. It's instructive to zoom on this low temperature region of phase diagram to see what's going on in the magnetic sector. And this is a compilation of data points by Mark Julian. He put results of on this phase diagram results of NMR and MUSR and NQR measurements, and this is temperature of magnetic transition inferred from all these different techniques. So magnetic anomalies are seen at somewhat higher temperatures in neutron scattering experiments, but typically around 25 Kelvin or so. Based on this data set, there is no doubt that this magnetic phase seen in the spin glass region also propagates into the superconducting region of the phase diagram. The only correlation between these two phase boundaries is somewhere around 1/8 anomaly. That's, you know, notorious 1/8 anomaly here. TC as a function of doping shows this small plateau. It could be a weak notch in other systems, and this magnetic ordering temperature is peaked. And also, if you examine the correlation length extracted from antiferromagnetic correlation length extracted from neutron scattering experiments, it's also peaked around this doping. I will show in one of my next slides. So coexistence of superconductivity and magnetism appears to be pretty well established over a very broad region of the phase diagram, and it's not entirely clear if these two effects originate from trivial phase separation or there is something more interesting going on in this weakly doped phases. And one important fairly recent contribution to this issue of phase understanding of magnetic order in this weakly doped phases comes from Yamada and his collaborators. And they were able to show that the spin glass state in weakly doped phases can be better described in terms of spin stripes, which are indeed diagonal at very low dopants, diagonal with respect to axis of tetragonal lattice, and they become collinear at about 5 or 6%, and in fact around 5%, the two phases seem to coexist. So we are facing yet another blurred phase boundary in this phase diagram corresponding to diagonal to collinear transition. It's important to point out that all evidence for stripes in LSCO, in pure LSCO without neodymium, comes from neutron scattering experiment, from probe of magnetic structure, and the charge ordering peaks that would correspond to this spin order have not been observed so far. Nevertheless, incommensurability of these magnetic peaks follows the same this famous Yamada plot, this linear dependence with doping, and that's this dependence is also observed in neodymium doped phases where both spin and charge stripes are firmly established. So similarity of this doping trend points to perhaps common nature of stripes in this weakly doped lanthanum 214 phases and stripes in neodymium doped compounds. So the bottom line is that in this region of phase diagram there is a lot of action, and we tried to explore the behavior of this material supplying infrared spectroscopy. This? Oh, this is degree. So that refers to 45 and 90 degree orientation of stripe. Yeah. So I guess it got lost in cyberspace when I was posting this from a PDF file. And this is the boundary where two phases may be coexisting. Okay. Two words about our experimental technique. In our measurements, we bounce light off a sample. We collect what's reflected, what can be easier than that. Casually, we refer to our measurements as to infrared spectroscopy, but in fact, we cover a much broader frequency range, spanning from almost microwaves all the way to UV light, and we are doing this continuously using a set of using two different or several different types of interferometers, and in particular for this frequency range, it's important to be able to do this continuously. This frequency interval is quite unique because it covers 4 or 5 decades in energy, and also it appears that many interesting energy scales in solids and also in correlated materials fall into this frequency range that we can cover with our technique. Provided spectral coverage is as broad as it is in our measurements, we can determine the optical constants of our materials, and that's important quantitative information, and all these different absorption mechanisms give additive contributions to the dissipative part of the optical conductivity to spectra of sigma 1 that I will be showing today. Optics, of course, is a natural technique to explore anisotropy effects in solids, and we try to take advantage of that, searching for anisotropy attributable to stripes in lanthanum 214 system. We can work with very small crystals. This is a snapshot of one of the YBCO crystals that we studied, and this snapshot has been taken with a scanning electron microscope. Although crystal size wasn't really an issue in this lanthanum 214 project, samples coming from UHE Ando are really, really big. And the information that we extract from our measurements is representative of a bulk of a sample. The probe and thickness is quite large. So I would like to start with this metal insulator transition in the vicinity of 5% doping. That's the region where resistivity goes from semiconducting behavior at low temperatures to metallic behavior. And generic trends in lanthanum 214 series have been studied long time ago by Uchida and his collaborators. This is the spectrum of the real part of the optical conductivity. This spectrum for undoped phase, you can see a clear charge transfer excitation around at around 1 electron volt. As strontium is added, spectral weight from this charge transfer channel is transferred to low energies, and eventually we start seeing a Lorentzian-like mode that can be at least qualitatively described with a Drude formula. So we start seeing metallic behavior. So one unexpected result that we obtained is that response of these weakly doped phases is actually appears to be metallic, metal-like as well. So this panel shows the real part of the conductivity for a series of samples starting from very low doping, from 1% and going all the way to 8% in this diagram. So as soon as 1% of strontium is added, we start seeing a substantial electronic contribution to the optical conductivity. As we move out of antiferromagnetic region of the phase diagram up to 3%, this Drude-like contribution, and I will show you in a second that this behavior can be fitted very nicely with simple Drude formula. This Drude behavior is obvious when we continue with strontium doping. This behavior is further enhanced all the way to, well, if I so basically what is happening is the amount of spectral weight, the area under the conductivity spectra, is increasing, but there are no radical changes in the frequency dependence of this response. All changes seem to be quite continuous from antiferromagnetic phase to superconducting phase at 8%. So in this panel, I show the results of a simple Drude model fit of the low frequency behavior for the 3% sample. These are dashed lines. Well, these crystals are anisotropic as well, but anisotropy is not that important for a moment. What is important is that I can account with a simple Drude formula for the behavior below 500 wave numbers, and the width, the 1 over tau parameter in the Drude term, is decreasing with temperature. That's yet another sign of metallic behavior at this very low dopings. And this effect is common for all weakly doped phases, and I was really surprised that the simple Drude fit works that nicely. You know, if you go to optimal doping or to higher dopings, that's no longer possible. You start seeing strong frequency dependence of 1 over tau. These results also allow us to comment on possible impact of clustering in this weakly doped lanthanum 214 phases. Local probes, primarily NMR and MUSR, are indicative of phase separation in this doping regimes, and phase separation into antiferromagnetically ordered, presumably insulating regions, and also regions of much higher carrier density. And this picture of metallic particles embedded into antiferromagnetic background, into insulating background, has been discussed by many authors, in particular by David Stroud, and this picture has well-defined consequences for optics that are pretty much model independent. And these are, or rather, similar behavior can be generated within very different models, and these are basic features of electromagnetic response of such clustered, phase-separated system, the conductivity appears to be peaked at finite frequency, and relevant energy scale here is the plasma frequency of your metallic particles. So as you start merging these clusters together, then start and they begin overlapping. Eventually, this mode shifts to lower energies, but still there is some persistence, some residue of this mode even in the overlapping range. But I think very important that this peak is really linked to the plasma frequency of metallic particles. So we would expect to find a feature that would shift down in that would shift in a systematic way in the spectra, and we are not observing it. Instead, we are seeing Judy-like behavior even at this very small dopings, indicative of band-like behavior, band-like transport in even in this weakly doped region of the phase diagram.
It's hard to read the labels on the
This is the density of metallic clusters is continuously increasing.
Yeah, but there's a concentration or something.
That's 0.3. That's 0.6. So.
We have clusters, but you're not getting anything at zero frequency because of the size of the cluster.
Pretty much so. Yes. So, you would expect, you know, if I. Take Muir-Sharp papers on the phase value, then at this doping regime, clusters are not supposed to be overlapping.
This is kind of like a percolation model.
That's right. That's a percolation model in 2D.
The position of this peak is at low peak, depending upon the size of the metallic particle.
Not that much on the size, but certainly on the number of carriers. It depends on the size when you know geometry is getting involved, you start overlapping, but if you just can you had a, there was another question.
In the 1% sample, the low temperature was distributed in the insulating light, and is the insulating behavior can it be described by activation level? What would be the activation energy?
I don't think it's very activated, actually. So I will come back to low temperature properties in a minute. I think it's lower than activated.
Those peaks are those just the phonons?
Yeah. There are several phonon peaks in this data, and in the 1% sample, the weight of these peaks is comparable to the electronic background, but. I will show spectra later on where these peaks were subtracted, but you kind of can separate them even without, you know, fitting, because these are really narrow modes at top of much broader electronic background.
When you get that same kind of thing, you have fairly ordered stripes.
Fairly ordered stripes. Well, if you have fairly ordered stripes, I think the first thing you would expect to find is strong anisotropy in the electronic response and along and across. And in some cases, we were able to see that. I'll come back to that in a moment. At the moment, what I'd like to say now is that this Drude-like behavior at small dopings is significant because Drude response is a hallmark of metallic transport in solids, and it looks like we are seeing this these hallmarks down to very very low dopings. This result is somewhat unexpected, but is consistent with other observations. Not so long, Yuichi Ando reported a very detailed studies of mobility and resistivity across the phase diagram, and he has been able to show that mobility of lanthanum-214 phase changes only by perhaps factor of 3 when you go all the way from 1% down to or up to 17% rare, and 17% is close to you know, Fermi liquid behavior in quotation marks. So in the same range, the resistivity drops by several orders of magnitude. And this result implies that this drop of the resistivity really occurs because we simply get more spectral weight of this metallic carriers, whereas the dynamics of this carriers is not really modified. In particular, there is nothing spectacular going on at 5% doping. If we integrate this low energy part of the conductivity covering most of the Drude tail, we do find this systematic increase of the spectral weight with doping that is, seems to be responsible for these changes of the resistivity. Again, there are no obvious changes at 5%, although we are looking at the moment at this crystal, so perhaps there is something there, but I think it's very, very unlikely. So this spectral weight evolves continuously across this superconductor insulator region of the phase diagram. There is nothing. There are no sharp changes. yet another indicator of band-like behavior in these materials has been found with angular resolve photoemission spectroscopy, and I think Atsushi Fujimori probably discussed this spectra on Monday. So what they found is that in ARPIS experiments, there is evidence for quasi-particle peak already at very small dopants at around 3%, and when they integrated the area under this peak, they found very good correlation with the whole number, with the linear increase of the spectral weight that we observe in our measurements. So again, no discontinuities at around 5% doping. If all the trends, all these metallic trends appear to be continuous. So two different spectroscopies and DC transport, and these two different spectroscopies, you know, looking at very different facets of electronic response of lanthanum 214, are indicative of this band-like response, even at very weak dopings. This metallic description of our data and of transport data holds down to about 80 Kelvin, and below 80 Kelvin, we observe quite radical changes in the frequency-dependent conductivity. This Drude-like behavior at finite temperatures now evolves, and Drude behavior is a Lorentzian mode centered at zero frequency. Now at low temperatures in these crystals, we start seeing a mode centered at finite frequency. These are DC values independently obtained from the resistivity measurements. So the peak in the 3% sample is very well resolved, experimentally at least, is very well resolved. Qualitatively, this form of the conductivity spectrum can be attributed to disorder-induced weak localization. Basically, you know, possible physical picture of that is that one needs to supply finite amount of energy in order to maintain metallic transport that we observe at higher frequencies. That's not the only interpretation, and I'll mention other interpretations as well, but within this picture, the frequency position of the peak quantifies the energy scale associated with localization. Apart from this behavior here, we do not find significant redistribution of the spectral weight below 80 Kelvin. So all changes are really confined to low frequencies and low temperatures. Which one?
The first one.
This one?
Yeah.
No, this is a phonon and goes off scale, goes to 2000 or something.
So which one is
the... And this peak is the electronic. Is the electronic background. It's much broader. It, you know, it's generated by shifting the weight of the Drude mode to a finite frequency. At least that's one way to look at this feature.
Why are the quantums so frequency so temperature dependent? I mean, they're fighting.
There are several reasons for that. First of all, at high temperatures, this is a tetragonal phase. So as you cool down, it's becoming orthorhombic, and there is a continuous split going on. And you also see actually different number of modes and different polarization, as I will say in a minute. Then the width of the phonons is also, you know, it's shrinking as you cool down. So they become very intense. I will show in one of my next slides. I'll have this spectra with phonons subtracted. Yes.
I suppose it's very hard to see because of the log scale. But you're saying that spectral wave is conserved, and the difference between the blue and the gray is that
between the
difference around 1,000 centimeters.
Between the blue and the green, it's conserved and conserved on a small energy scale. Between the red and green, it's not as nicely conserved, and if it's conserved, it's conserved on a much broader energy scale. So yes, what I really wanted to say is that I think it's an important point, is that there is plenty of spectral weight under the low temperature conductivity down to the lowest frequencies. So this result, as well as the linear and continuous increase of the spectral weight with doping, indicate that crossover to the semiconducting behavior that we observe in these crystals is not related to opening of a charge gap, but is related to modification of dynamics of metallic carriers. I think, somewhat unexpected that the low energy response remains gapless, and perhaps a good term to use to describe this behavior would be an Anderson insulator, as opposed to an insulator with an energy gap. In this slide, I would like to show you the evolution of this localization mode through the phase diagram. So in the 1% sample at 1% doping, the peak in the conductivity is not that easy to see. You definitely need to subtract phonons in order to see that, or even then maybe you need some imagination, but you definitely see a crossing of the high temperature conductivity and low temperature conductivity at the lowest frequencies, and it is this crossing that's responsible for semiconducting upturn of the resistivity. The peak is not easy to see because phonon spectral weight is the same or maybe even stronger than the electronic spectral weight. At 3%, that's becoming a little bit easier. This peak, this localization mode is fairly well resolved. There is much more spectral weight. The vertical scales are different. And it's also shifted down to lower energies, and this trend continues as we go to 4% doping. This mode is becoming even stronger. Its frequency position perhaps is not changing that much, but this peak is definitely there. However, this peak is no longer observed in superconducting crystals. This right panel shows the data for the 8% sample. The green line is at TC. The conductivity continues to increase monotonically. There is no sign of similar downturn. And as far as we can tell, that's the only difference between superconducting and non-superconducting phases. There is plenty of electronic spectral weight even in this non-superconducting phases. And the only thing that is different is that, you know, frequency dependence is modified. Its localization mode is no longer observed.
Frequency of the peak seems to be roughly independent.
That's right. It's really hard to say. You know, these dopings are also quite close. If I do this phonon subtraction and I try to recognize a peak here, then it will be somewhat high in energy. I think it shifts down. What I really would like to do is to measure this 5-6% sample right at this borderline and see what's going with this mode there. So this, the most important similarity, as I already tried to point out, is that there is plenty of spectral weight, and it's only frequency dependence that's modified across this insulated to superconductor transition boundaries. So it appears that, summarizing this part, it appears that the metallic transport in a MOT insulator occurs at very small dopants, is initiated essentially instantly as soon as you start putting just a tiny amount of strontium. But dynamics of these metallic carriers is modified across the phase diagram, and I would argue that this modification of dynamics is the main reason for the superconductor insulator transition that we observe around 5 or 6%. Of course, we would like to study this this phase.
Sorry, and then how do you distinguish a localized mode from a phonon?
It's much broader. It's much. It's you can look at the temperature dependence. Phonon modes are in the insulator one. You really need to subtract phonons first. But you definitely see the electronic background. You know, phonons end at around 100 wave numbers, but there is substantial electronic background extending down to lowest energies. Yes.
Is there a significant doping dependence at low doping of the metallic resistivity?
Maybe you can show them. Yeah, I had it in one of the previous slides, I think. I think slope does change. What? It's again. It will be a log scale, so you can't really say much about slope. So why don't I move on and so I would like to say a little bit more about the superconductor insulator transition in lanthanum 214. Turning now to neodymium doped phases. So here I show again data for the. Here I show again data for the 4% sample, and that's this localization mode in the conductivity. This is the data for the 8%. Dependence is Drude-like, and dependence is continues to be Drude-like even we go to further dopings. When we cool down these crystals below superconducting transition, the conductivity is suppressed at low energies due to opening of superconducting gap. This spectral weight shown in blue is often referred to as missing spectral weight in the conductivity, but of course this weight is not missing, but it's transferred under superconducting delta function at the origin. So this weight quantifies the density of superconducting condensate. As a side remark, I would like to point out that we do not find in this lanthanum 214 crystals, we do not find significant discrepancy between missing area and the strength of superconducting delta function. Such a discrepancy can be interpreted in terms of lowering of kinetic energy, but in these very underdoped phases, it's not observed. With our error bars, which are about 10%.
Larger at 0.8 than at 0.12.
It's actually it's not larger, but it's the same. This scale roughly the same. The scales are vertical scales are slightly different, but the reason why they are the same is because there is this suppression of the superfluid density at 1/8 doping. So we think that's 1/8 phase. So now I'll try to show you what's going on when we add neodymium in these compounds. And neodymium doped crystals have been studied in details. Neutron scattering on these crystals have been, and transport too has been studied by Yamada and his collaborators, by Tranquada and his collaborators. And neodymium initiates static stripes, statically ordered charge stripes in these compounds. So the neodymium concentrations that we were examining are actually sufficient to completely suppress superconductivity in these two phases, and charge stripes have been firmly established in these compounds. The black lines show the low temperature conductivity of the neodymium doped phases, and you can see again this localization mode that we've previously seen in weakly doped phases. So these crystals are not superconducting. The localization mode develops primarily at the expense of this superfluid density that is no longer observed in this non-superconducting phases. That's, as far as we can tell, that's pretty much the only difference between non-superconducting neodymium doped compounds and superconducting phases. Again, we observe modification of charge dynamics in this very specific form, in modification that produces this localization peak at finite frequencies. In this sense, neodymium doping is not any different from zinc impurities in YBCO that we investigated some time ago. Again, zinc induces localization and also pair breaking, destroying this superfluid density in the copper oxygen planes. Okay. One important difference between neodymium doping and zinc doping is that zinc, of course, goes directly into the copper oxygen planes, and neodymium is located remotely on the lanthanum side. It is therefore especially intriguing that these localization trends in these two cases are similar, and at least qualitatively, so neodymium does essentially the same thing as when you put zinc in the copper oxygen plane, you mess directly with the copper oxygen planes, and certainly localization trends would be enhanced if you have a crossover from 2D to 1D behavior. So indirectly, these results are supportive of strike picture and of quasi one-dimensional transport in these systems. Very indirectly, of course. 0.6 here in this crystal. So superconductivity is gone completely. We looked at intermediate concentrations, and you can recognize again continuous trends. So stripes, and of course the question if these stripes are what people think they are, if they really can be described as rivets of charge embedded into antiferromagnetic insulator that's taken from peer-reviewed publications. And of course, an obvious consequence of such a picture of 1D transport would be an isotropy between directional on stripes and the cross stripes. And unfortunately, in most systems, it cannot be seen directly, because in neodymium doped compounds, stripes in the neighboring copper oxygen planes are twisted 90 degree with respect to each other. And the unique advantage of this weakly doped phases is that stripes are not twisted, and that one can prepare an untwinned, or Yoichi Ando rather can prepare an untwinned crystal of lanthanum 214 that will allow us to study an isotropy of the conductivity along these two directions. And conductivity is indeed is quite an isotropic. So here I show the data. The phonon structure is quite an isotropic. We observe more phonon peaks in this polarization than in the other polarization. The electronic background at low temperatures is an isotropic as well. This finite energy peak, this mode, is shifted to higher energy in this perpendicular polarization. So the reason for parallel and perpendicular notation is the following. Parallel refers to E vector along the spin stripes in this lanthanum 214 system, and perpendicular is across this stripe direction. As I have already pointed out, this peak, the frequency position of the peak, can be taken as a quantitative measure of the localization scale, and if that is a correct interpretation, we would expect to find a corresponding effect in the resistivity data. That's what is plotted in the top panel. That's temperature dependence of the resistivity along these two directions. This is frequency dependent conductivity at 10 Kelvin, and you can see that hardening of the electronic mode here is also reflected in the resistivity data, this crossover between metallic and this upturn of the resistivity occurs at somewhat higher temperature in the perpendicular data. The anisotropy is largest, is maximized in the limit of low temperatures and low frequencies, and is about 70% in this doping. So this panel shows data for 3 and 4%, again, conductivity with phonons subtracted, so these are a little bit prettier spectra without this sharp phonon peaks and resistivity. Again, and in both cases, we observe hardening of this finite energy peak in the perpendicular polarization than in parallel. So let me summarize this the data first. So in this weakly doped phases, we find that the conductivity at high temperatures is isotropic and metallic at the same time. At low temperature, the anisotropy develops, and also the form of the conductivity spectra is modified. Instead of Drude behavior, we start seeing this localization mode. And in both 3 and 4% dopings, we know that the conductivity is enhanced for the direction along the spin stripes. So it's very tempting to interpret these experiments in terms of charge stripes. But before we rush to this interpretation, it's also imperative to discuss other more prosaic scenarios, and first of all, the role of orthorhombicity. We know these crystals are orthorhombic, or they are tetragonal at high temperatures. They become orthorhombic at low temperatures, and we see this, the impact of that in the phonon spectra. At high temperatures, we observe 4 phonon peaks. This fourth mode is not that easy to see because it's fairly weak and broad at high temperature, but it's still noticeable. These modes have been assigned a long time ago, and this is some jargon from the mode assignment. When we cool down these crystals, a large number of phonons is expected for the orthorhombic phase. Actually, Gersh Blumberg was the first who pointed out this to us. And we are in fair agreement with the data in this perpendicular polarization. We would expect 7 modes. We perhaps observe 8. And in the parallel polarization, we expect a smaller number of modes, 4, and that's what we observe in the data. So crystal is orthorhombic, and the question is if orthorhombicity can account for the anisotropy that we observe. And the short answer is no, and the little longer answer is the following. So these crystals are orthorhombic at all temperatures below 450 Kelvin or so. However, anisotropy develops only at low temperatures, and it's connected with very specific modification of the frequency dependent of the conductivity with the formation of this localization mode in the data. Another reason is spectral weight, that the area under the conductivity along these two directions appears to be isotropic. And to the best of my knowledge, all other orthorhombic systems always show an enhancement of the electronic spectral weight when it's probed in the polarization along a shorter axis, and it's easy to to understand why it's going on, this spectral weight is proportional to the Hopin integral. You always have more Hopin along shorter axis, and it's not happening here. So the two parallel and perpendicular Hopin integrals estimated from integrating the conductivity appear to be roughly the same. The origin of the anisotropy is really in this hardening of this localization mode that I tried to emphasize. So we can conclude that the observed anisotropy cannot really be accounted by orthorhombicity, calling for alternative explanations. And certainly considerable electronic anisotropy is expected within nearly isotropic copper oxygen planes, is expected if it's difficult to reconcile with homogeneous charge distribution, and may be expected within this picture of charge stripes. And in this context, I think it's quite important that localization trends that we observe in the data and development of anisotropy go hand in hand with each other. So the both of these effects are observed on the at low temperatures. And of course, within this stripe charge picture, it's not surprising that charge transport is isotropic and metallic at high temperature, and that anisotropy is always accompanied by this localization form. Certainly localization is more favorable when you if you have a crossover from quasi-2G to quasi-1D behavior. Having said all that, I need to add that stripes, at least in our crystals, hardly resemble a hypothetical picture of rivers of charge embedded into antiferromagnetic insulator. Certainly, the response that we observe has little to do with the behavior of one-dimensional conductors. And we had, first of all, the anisotropy that we observe in our data is around 70%, not several orders of magnitude. And that's certainly different. And also, perhaps the most radical distinction is that these two Hopin integrals are exactly the same. But I think this reference, this quasi one-dimensional conductors, is really not a very good reference to understand what's going on in the stripe situation. You may recall that origins of quasi 1D transport are always linked to underlying crystal structure in organics, and there is nothing underlying. There is no such interdirectionality of chemical bonds, and we don't have these factors in copper oxides. And I would like to also remind that stripes have been devised as purely electronic effect. And this point of view has recently been supported by numerical work of Steve White and of others. And so crystal structure is not underlying this anisotropy, and therefore this 60 or 70% effect that we observe within nominally isotropic copper oxygen planes is quite significant. Also, it's easy to imagine that either stripes or large fragments of stripe pattern in a situation when the coupling to the lattice is very loose, so either stripes or fragments of stripe pattern can become mobile in the transverse direction, and that was the picture discussed by Zanon and by Kivelson. And these transverse degrees of freedom, again, are not present in conventional 1D conductors, and but certainly conceivable here. And the presence of these new degrees of freedom may account for fairly weak anisotropy that we observe in these phases. Basically, this weak anisotropy is a result of competition between unidirectional conduction along the stripes and ability of stripes to move in the crystal. How am I doing on time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, I'll try to run through another topic very quickly, which is charge ordering around 1/8 anomaly, and what I told you so far was primarily a story of stripes in non-superconducting crystals. Now I would like to say a few words about stripes in superconducting phases, and in this experiment we will explore the behavior of interlayer conductivity between the copper-oxygen planes. So we'll try to probe in homogeneous nature of charge within the planes by studying the C-axis current. And along the C-axis, many cuprates and lanthanum 2-1 flow in particular are nearly insulating, and that can be seen in raw reflectance data. This is data obtained at TC for the 8% doped crystal. The dominant features are sharp horn and peaks, and this reflectance in far infrared is flat and featureless. An electronic background would show is an upturn of reflectance towards one, and we were not able to see this upturn even when we lowered down to about 300 gigahertz in our measurements. When we cool down these crystals, reflectance is modified quite radically, and we start seeing this plasma edge in superconducting reflectance along the C-axis. And this feature can be directly linked to ability of superconducting pairs to propagate along the C-axis. The development of this plasma edge is fairly well understood. I'll skip all the technical details. The minimum in reflectance occurs at the frequency, at the longitudinal frequency of this Josephson plasma that's proportional to the superfluid density, and the shape of the plasma edge can be described very nicely, very simply within the simplest possible two-fluid model. You have superfluid contribution and you have normal fluid contribution. If you start adding the normal contribution to superconducting contribution, you observe two effects that always occur simultaneously. The plasma, the reflectance in the minimum goes up, and the plasma edge is smeared. And this two-fluid model roughly accounts for the data. But first, let me run through the data that we obtained for 8 different crystals in the doping range from 8% to 20%. In all cases, you see this plasma edge. The position, the dominant effect is the shift of this minimum to higher frequencies. In fact, it was not possible to show all these, to resolve all these peaks using the same horizontal axis in this eight panels. Now I'll try to overlay the two-fluid model fit, and in this case, you basically cannot see the difference between two-fluid model and the data, and it's hard to see difference here. Difference is obvious at around this 1/8 doping, and in fact, we asked Yuichi to grow a single crystal for us in a separate growth to make sure that this effect is real. So you see that the plasma edge around 1/8 continues to be sharp. However, the minimum is very shallow. Reflectivity in the minimum is enhanced. We can try to fit it can try to describe this behavior using a model for inhomogeneous superconductor proposed by Dirk van der Marel. And essentially, this model suggests that there could be a distribution of the superfluid densities, and the simplest way to describe this distribution is with a Gaussian. Here I show again the blue lines are experimental data. The gray lines were generated using this fit with a Gaussian width for the superfluid density distribution. The fit is successful this time at all dopings. That's perhaps not surprising since we have an extra parameter. However, the width of this Gauss distribution is also displayed with the red line, and it's very narrow at low dopings or at high dopings, which is again understandable since simple two-fluid fit was sufficient to describe this result. However, it is systematically enhanced as we go towards 1/8, and then it's becoming suppressed again. So this is the dope independence of this Gaussian width that we obtained from this analysis. And it appears that this Gaussian width tracks the coherence length for antiferromagnetic coherence length extracted from neutron scattering experiments. This coherence length is enhanced, strongly enhanced around 1/8 doping, just exactly where this width of the superfluid distribution is increased. So it's conceivable that these two effects may be related to each other. And accepting this point of view, one can think of several scenarios for broadening of the of the plasma minimum in around 1/8. This can be related to extra periodicity due to stripe ordering, and then this extra periodicity will allow us to pick up modes at finite momentum, not just at zero momentum. Also, one can imagine several distinct regions within the copper oxygen planes and tunneling within this between these two different regions or several different regions will produce different LO frequencies that we are observing here. In any case, either of these scenarios is really suggestive of charge ordering that occurs around 1/8 doping. So, let me summarize and try to shift to my I don't really have time to cover this Josephson part, and I would like to jump straight to the conclusions. If I can. And in these conclusions, I would like to reiterate some of the challenges for the realistic theories of correlated electron materials that follow from this data for very weakly doped phases of lanthanum 214. I think it's somewhat non-trivial that metallic transport in these crystals is originated at extremely low dopings, so Mott state characterized by a large gap in the charge excitation spectrum appears to be unstable against very, very small dopings. As far as we can tell, phase separation is not really relevant to the description of electrodynamics at these very low dopings. Spin-ordered states in lanthanum 214 without neodymium also trigger quite interesting charge effects, and in this very weakly doped phases we observe an isotropy of the conductivity between the two directions. At around 1/8 doping we also find evidence for charge ordering, although in a very different way. And this charge ordered state really reveal quite complicated behavior and complicated AC response. And I tried to use localization to describe what's going on, and I really used localization just to emphasize gapless nature of electromagnetic response at these very low dopings. And other interpretations of this feature are certainly possible, and I was interested to hear what Girsch yesterday had to say about collective nature of transport at these small dopings. Thank you for your attention.
Questions? Antoine?
I just would like to know if there are NMR data available at these ultra-low doping.
Yes, there are data from IMAI. Which actually were in the, you know, he was among those who arguing for, you know, granular nature of this very undoped phases.
Do you remember what 1/T1 does in that regime?
No, I don't have No, I don't remember.
When you look at the metal insulator transition in ordinary semiconductors, you have to distinguish between the on-site Coulomb correlation, which leads to a Hubbert gap, and to the long-range Coulomb interaction, which is responsible, say, for Altshuler-Aronoff anomalies in the metallic side, or this Efrosovsky hopping on the insulating side. And the question is, how much of this scenario, which seems to be rather general in semiconductors, is actually found in the epimetal insulator transition in the cuprates?
Well, this these scenarios are, you know, experimental confirmation comes often from the analysis of power laws in resistivity, and I don't think we have enough information to do that. Of course, predictions for the frequency dependence that come from say Coulomb gap scenario are also present, and again, in order to verify them, you know, qualitatively, you would expect, you know, the conductivity that's growing as a function of frequency. If you want to determine the power law, you want to have a couple of more decays, perhaps, in frequency. We don't have that at the moment. Yeah, would be.
I just want to, coming back to your question, I was just want to warn and comment about metal insulator transition. We have to be extremely careful. If you remember, we have to remember the early works of 95 of Greg Bobinger and Yoichi Ando that basically shows that all these samples are insulating. The superconductivity just kicks in the insulator regime, but if you suppress the superconducting phase, they will all show insulating upturns. So this all phase is an insulator. Well, that's what I think Greg would say. And he would interpret this as a metal insulator transition, at least up to optimal doping at all.
What I want to add to this, that this insulator, or whatever is the term we are using, is gapless insulator. There is no gap, no obvious gap in the charge excitation spectrum.
There is no activated right. Has not been measured.
So my proposal is to continue discussion after second talk, and let's thank Dmitry for nice.